This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In a courtroom in Los Angeles County, a defense attorney named Alan Jackson. Yes, that Alan Jackson. Not the country singer Alan Jackson, the true crime Alan Jackson, you know, from Karen Reid. Yeah, he's Frazier's defense attorney. It's the guy you want if you want to get away with something, right? A defense attorney stood before a judge and said something that hung in the air like a challenge to both logic and law. Speed is not malice. It's a clean line. Calm, measured, almost reasonable on its face. And maybe that's the point. Because when you strip away the images of crushed steel and broken glass, four young women whose futures ended on the side of Pacific Coast Highway, you're left with a philosophical question that's been chasing the justice system for decades. When does reckless behavior, the kind that everyone knows can kill, cross over into murder? The defendant is 22-year-old Frazier Michael Bohm. And the four people that are dead: Nima Rolston, who was 20, Peyton Stewart, who was 21, Isha Weir, 21, and Deslin Williams, 21, all seniors at Pepperdine University, all friends, all members of the same sorority. October 17th of 2023, it was one of those Malibu nights that only really exist in the minds of most of us who don't have memories of Malibu nights, but let's say you did. When the wind whips up off the ocean and the lights from the hillside houses blink like scattered embers, PCH is what it's known as, the Pacific Coast Highway. I think most of us have heard of it, whether we've been on it or not. It's famous for its beauty and notorious for its danger. Locals call the stretch near Las Flores Canyon Dead Man's Curve. It's not poetic. It is a warning. It is speaking from the past, history, facts, reality. History, facts, and reality also tell us that all too often young people behind the wheel of powerful vehicles make bad decisions. That's what happened. That night, prosecutors say Bohm was behind the wheel of his gray BMW M8, a car built for the Autobahn, but unleashed instead on a two-lane road lined with beach homes and parked cars. The posted speed limit, 45 miles an hour. According to the data recovered from the car, he was going more than 100 miles an hour. More of that pesky vehicle data. At 104 miles an hour, exactly, physics take control. One mistake, one bump, one shift of a tire, and you're no longer driving. You are flying. Blind. Investigators say that is exactly what happened. The BMW slammed into three parked cars along the shoulder, which then spun into four women who happened to be walking nearby. The scene was catastrophic. Within seconds, all four were dead. Of course! Bohm survived. You're the one person you're like, you know, if this world took this person out, I don't think it would be that bad of a place. He lived. The one who made the decision that I can defy the odds. I can risk it all. Nothing's going to go bad here. Someone with that stupid of logic. It takes the time to get his hair done for the murder trial. He lived. He was treated for minor injuries. And the headlines wrote themselves. The district attorney's office charged him with 4 counts of murder and 4 counts of vehicular manslaughter with gross negligence. The kind of charging decision that instantly divides people. Some say it was long overdue accountability for reckless driving. Others saw it as legal overreach, an emotional reaction to a tragedy that, while horrific, wasn't intentional. If I walked up to my house and poured gasoline on it and decided, this seems like a good place to smoke, and an ember fell down onto that gasoline and lit the house afire, but I wasn't intending on burning the house and I was just intending on pouring gasoline around. Why? That's fun. Who doesn't like pouring gasoline on stuff? I mean, the same could be said about someone who's, why are you driving recklessly in a very dangerous place? It's fun. It's not a good idea, but it's fun. He finds that fun. One may find that fun. He got in the car. That's basically lighting the match, lighting the cigarette, lighting the ember that could go horribly, horribly wrong in the situation that you have just chosen to set yourself up in. And when it goes horribly wrong, it wasn't intentional. At some point, it kind of is. Just because you have a mental block that says this isn't intentional, cause and effect says it is. So it kind of is. Alan Jackson doesn't think so. That's where the phrase, speed is not malice, comes in. It's the cornerstone of his defense. He's argued before Judge Thomas Rubinson that what Boehm did, even if he was speeding outrageously, doesn't meet the legal threshold for murder under California law. And he might be right. We're arguing words and law. And look, Alan Jackson is good at that job. He is. He may be that person that finds loopholes in cases and is able to set guilty people free. But that's a matter, too, of perception. But he is damn good at spinning a story so you see it in a specific way. And that way may or may not be wrong. Again, according to California law. California law recognizes something called implied malice. It's a concept that doesn't require proof that someone intended to kill. It just requires showing that the person knew their actions were dangerous to human life and deliberately acted with conscious disregard for that danger. In simpler terms, you don't have to want to kill. You just have to know you probably could and not care. That's what prosecutors believe happened on that dark stretch of PCH. They say Boehm's speed wasn't a momentary lapse in a simple mistake. It was a choice made on a road he knew at a speed he knew was deadly. They point out that he wasn't some naive teenager who didn't understand the risk. He'd lived through this before. Boehm had friends who died in high-speed crashes. He talked about it. He knew that this road, this exact curve, had taken lives before. So when the defense says speed is not malice, the prosecution answers, but knowing speed kills and doing it anyway, maybe it is. That's the line the judge had to consider this week when Boehm's attorney asked to have the murder charges thrown out. After hearing arguments, Judge Rubinson said, no, we're not throwing him out. He refused. The murder charges stay. Alan Jackson's doing his job. And depending how you interpret the law in California, he may or may not be right. That's why this is happening. That's why you have these procedural hearings that are going on. This trial has not even started yet. This is a hearing. The trial's coming up next year, and you bet we will be covering it. These are some things they had to iron out going in. At the end of the day, 4 young women are dead. because of one man's horrible choices. The case now moves forward to trial. But it's worth pausing there, because this isn't just about Boehm. It's about what the justice system wants to say and what we as a society are ready to accept about accountability. For generations, fatal car crashes have occupied this strange moral gray zone. We call them accidents, even when they're not. We treat them like tragic misfortunes rather than crimes. Unless someone is drunk, high, or fleeing police, a public instinct is to see a driver as drivers don't lie. In 2023 alone, more than 42,000 people died on U.S. roads, most from preventable causes: speed, distraction, impatience, arrogance. So how many of those drivers, if we're honest, really didn't know the risk? That's the argument prosecutors are making in this case. That knowing and doing it anyway, that's the malice. They cite data downloaded from his car's airbag module, the speed climbing past 100 miles an hour just before impact, the throttle still engaged, the control systems activating as he lost grip. They note he wasn't impaired. He was being chased, or wasn't being chased, wasn't trying to save anyone's life. He was, by all accounts, just driving fast for the sake of driving fast. But the defense paints a different picture. They claim Boehm was being chased or provoked by another driver, that there was a road rage element, a confrontation that escalated, leading him to accelerate dangerously in the heat of the moment. They argue this wasn't indifference, it was panic. They also emphasize that implied malice requires subjective awareness of risk, meaning you can't just look at what should have been obvious. You have to prove the driver actually understood and ignored the danger. That's a tough standard to meet, and it's why so few speeding deaths end in murder charges. Usually it's manslaughter. Usually it's framed as gross negligence, not conscious disregard. But they got the right guy for auto accidents. And yet, this case, the judge said the evidence was enough to let a jury decide. And so they will. That decision isn't small. It means that this isn't just a story about a crash. It's a test case for where we draw the boundary between recklessness and murder. When you talk to residents who live along that stretch of highway, they'll tell you it is a death trap. They've begged for years for more patrols, more lights, speed cameras, barriers. They've watched cars fly down the road like missiles, and they've learned to listen for that sound, that split-second roar before impact. They'll tell you this crash wasn't an isolated event. It was inevitable. And for the families of the four girls, that inevitability is part of the pain. These were four young women who'd done nothing wrong. They weren't drinking. They weren't crossing illegally. They weren't distracted. They were just there, walking on a road that should have been safe but wasn't. Each of their families has spoken publicly since the crash. They talk about their daughters as full, vibrant human beings, future lawyers, artists, nurses, daughters, sisters. They use words like joyful, kind, driven. They visit the roadside memorial lined with flowers, photos, and candles. And they wait. Because to them, this isn't a philosophical debate. It is personal. They don't want to hear that speed isn't malice. They've lived the consequence of that kind of thinking. Still, the defense isn't entirely wrong to raise the concern. If the law starts labeling all high-speed deaths as murder, where does the line stop? Is every driver doing 90 in a 65 a potential killer? Yeah. Does malice depend on the number of lives taken or the amount of luck involved? That's the uncomfortable space this case occupies. And it's not new. California has wrestled with this before. Back in 2001, a case out of Los Angeles involved a street racer whose crash killed another driver. The court upheld his second-degree murder conviction because he'd been warned repeatedly by friends and police about the deadly potential of his driving and ignored those warnings. That precedent is exactly what prosecutors cite now. You can't fix stupid, but you can hold them accountable. If Boehm, too, had been explicitly warned, if he talked about prior crashes and admitted he knew the danger, that could satisfy the exact same standard. But here's the human piece. Boehm isn't some faceless villain. He's a kid from a privileged background who made a horrific decision. That's the part that makes this case so combustible. The optics are difficult. A wealthy young man in a luxury sports car on a deadly road, four college women killed, a community in grief. It hits every raw nerve in the public consciousness. Class, accountability, empathy, and anger. And while his attorney argues for restraint, the public looks at the wreckage and wonders, how restrained would we be if it were our daughters? You can almost feel the tension between the law's slow precision and the community's desperate need for justice. When the defense stood before the court this week and said, speed is not malice, the phrase might have sounded like legal logic, but it also sounded like a plea for forgiveness, because underneath it, there's an acknowledgement that this is an unspeakable tragedy, and that tragedy alone shouldn't dictate punishment. But then you think of the sound. The shriek of the tires, the crunch of impact, the silence afterward, and it's hard to separate emotion from law. That's what juries are for. And if this goes to trial, the prosecutors will try to show that Boehm's actions were not a mere accident, but a foreseeable consequence of arrogance. They'll use data, prior statements, expert witnesses, in accident reconstruction. They'll likely bring in testimony about his familiarity with that section of Pacific Coast Highway. The defense will push back with their own experts, mechanical engineers, psychologists, maybe even human factors specialists, to argue that panic and fear, not disregard, drove his split-second choices. And every frame of body cam footage, every photo, every second of car telemetry will be poured over to answer a single question. What was in his mind before he hit the gas pedal? Because the difference between manslaughter and murder isn't in the crash itself. It's in that mental state. That's the haunting truth of implied malice. It's invisible. You can't see it in the wreckage. You have to infer it. So this becomes not just a legal case, but a psychological one. What compels someone to drive that fast? Adrenaline, anger, youthful invincibility? What convinces a person that they'll be the exception? That the laws of physics won't apply to them this time? As a term psychologists use, optimism bias. It's the belief that bad things happen to other people. And we all seem to have a strong case of it when we're young. You see it every time someone texts while driving or blows through a yellow light. It's a human mind's quiet lie. I'll be fine. Maybe Boehm believed that too. Maybe that's what killed four people. And maybe in a courtroom, that belief that blindness is what prosecutors will try to translate into malice. The irony is that nothing about this feels malicious in the everyday sense. There was no hatred, no pain, no desire to harm. But the law doesn't need hate. You just need proof that you knew better. That's what implied malice really means. And if the evidence shows that Boehm did, that he knew this road, knew the danger, knew the stakes, then maybe speed does become malice. And maybe there is hate involved. Because if you're willing to put yourself into that kind of a position, that kind of a risk, where death is a very real possibility, not only to others, but to yourself, I would argue there might be some self-hate going on there. People who are really good with themselves, don't do shit like this. The case also forces a look at the broader picture, Pacific Coast Highway itself. Local activists have been calling it one of the deadliest roads in California for years. There have been countless petitions to install speed cameras, add barriers, redesign shoulders. Some residents say there's been asking for the change since the 1980s. But Malibu's geography, narrow, scenic, lined with million-dollar homes, mistakes large-scale redesigns politically and physically difficult. It's hard to get anything to get changed there. So the deaths continue. In that sense, this tragedy isn't just about one driver. It's about a system that allows the same kind of crash to happen again and again until one finally shocks people enough to demand change. If this case pushes lawmakers to address PCH's dangers, speed control, enforcement infrastructure, then maybe some good will come of it. But for four families, it's already too late. There's another layer here that is harder to talk about. Empathy. It's easy to hate the driver in stories like this. It's harder to acknowledge that he's probably living through a different kind of nightmare. He's out on $4 million bail because he's privileged as fuck. But his life is over in almost every other sense. And maybe it should be. Not everybody is worth saving, no matter how much money you came from. He's become a symbol of recklessness, privilege, and youth gone wrong. If he's convicted, he could spend decades in prison. Okay. If he's acquitted, he'll still live with what happened, forever defined by the worst seconds of his life. I'm trying to find empathy here. I'm just not. You made that choice. You made that choice. Now live with it. I don't have to feel empathy for you. No one does. No one has to feel bad for you. You need to be held accountable. And if that means your life is ruined, well, so be it. You just took four out. You're still living. Nothing's going to bring back those four girls. So sorry why I don't give a shit that you'll end up in prison somewhere for the rest of your life. I don't care. I don't think anyone needs to. And for your family, it sucks. They probably love you and had high hopes for you, and you failed them. Judging by your decision-making process, if it wasn't this, you would have failed them somewhere else. Guaranteed. You just seem to be that type of person. That's my opinion anyway. It's a heartbreak of these cases. Even the perfect verdict can't fix what is broken. What it can do, maybe, is remind the rest of us that speed, that simple, stupid temptation to push the limit, it carries a moral cost. When you're behind the wheel of a machine that weighs nearly 2 tons, your choices ripple outward. They can end lives. They can redefine your own. That's why speed is not malice. Might be true in theory, but meaningless in practice. Because once the line between thrill and tragedy is crossed, it doesn't matter what you intended. In the months ahead, as this case moves towards trial, every word of that argument will be dissected. The defense will frame it as a cautionary tale about overcriminalization. The prosecution will frame it as the logical endpoint of accountability. And the rest of us watching from the outside will have to decide what we believe justice looks like. Maybe the real question isn't whether speed is malice. Maybe it's whether indifference is. Because indifference kills just as surely as hatred does. And sometimes it even dresses better. The law calls it implied malice. The families call it loss. And for everyone left standing on that highway, listening to the waves crash against the rocks below, the only sound louder than the wind is the silence of what could have been. Tell me your thoughts in the comment section. You can do that on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That's where our content lives. If you're watching or listening to us on the podcast platforms, hit subscribe there, please. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If you're not already there, you can take us with us and listen to commentary anywhere. We're on every social media, too, so find us where you like to be. And follow and subscribe. There's a lot more coming up on this case. I can already feel it. I can already feel the anger brewing deep within on the stupidity of this little monster, whose stupid face can be behind bars forever. And I don't think the world is really going to be missing out much on his potential. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.